In the Gospel of Luke, Luke tells us at the very beginning of the Gospel that he's got the other Gospels available to him, Matthew and Mark, and he has interviewed people, he's sought the resources that he finds necessary, and he sets about this orderly account of the life of Jesus. And it's clear that somewhere in this, he has discovered that the centrality of Jerusalem. That Jerusalem is the beginning and end of all things for Luke. And so the gospel begins in Jerusalem and it ends in Jerusalem. And punctuated throughout the gospel are these continuing references to Jerusalem. We're here in the middle of the 9th chapter. And this is the conclusion to the ministry of Jesus up in Galilee. And at the end of this chapter, in chapter 9, verse 51, we have this decided change. We have Jesus saying he resolutely sets his face towards Jerusalem. And then there's just this continual mention on this road trip over the next 10 or 11 chapters of Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. So this first part of the ministry of Jesus up in Galilee has been all about Jesus as the Messiah. As he begins his ministry there in Nazareth, also up in Galilee, and he opens the scroll of the prophet Isaiah and reads from chapter 61 that all of these things of the Anointed One are being fulfilled in his ministry. And now he's able to finally let the curtains fall. The mask can be removed. He can be declared and revealed in all of his glory there before his three chosen disciples, the inner circle who were there as part of the continuing ministry of Jesus. But this powerful sense of this transformation that happens. To get a sense of what this is all about, we need to spend a bit more time in our first reading tonight from the book of Genesis. And it's significant because here in Genesis 15, Abraham, who had been called, that we first meet Abraham at the end of chapter 11, chapter 12, he's called to go. Leave your nation, leave your people, leave your family, leave your possessions and go to a nation, to a place that I will show you. There's no GPS, there's no tracking, there's no system of knowing where that will be. Abraham is just told and invited to go. And he does. He doesn't quite follow that because he brings along some of his possessions. He brings along his nephew, which causes him no end of trouble along the way. But Abraham sets out in faith to follow the call of the Lord. But there is no descendant. He hasn't yet had a child. He's been in the promised land when we meet him in chapter 15 for about 25 years. He's about 75 when he's called, and he's about 100 at this point. Still, no child. And then we're told that the Lord invites him to take it outside, to go outside and to look up to the sky and to count the stars if you can. Now, it's kind of interesting because what time of the day is this taking place? We presume it's nighttime, right? And yet in verse 12, we're told the sun was beginning to set. And then verse 17, we're told it was now getting dark because the sun was setting. So in verse 5, what time of the day is it? Broad daylight. So if you go out into the daylight and look up at the sky and count the number of stars if you can, how many stars can we see? One. Just the sun. It's the only star that we can see. And yet Abraham at that point still trusts in the Lord, because he knows that there's only one star that he can see, and yet he knows that once that thing sets, then the rest of the stars are revealed, all of the 6,000 stars or so that we're able to see with the naked eye are finally revealed in all of their glory and without all of the light pollution that would have been, you know, that we suffer from, that we're not able to see much of the night sky, apart from the fact that it's so cloudy and wet usually. But we're able to see just this wonderful spectrum of stars. In the middle of the day, all you can see is the one star. And how many sons will Abraham actually end up having? Just the one. That is enough. Because Abraham trusts in the Lord, and that is counted to him as righteousness. And then God makes this extraordinary promise at the end of this whole promise, as he sends him into a deep sleep, and as he moves among the all of the offerings that are there, and you know, that's just a bizarre and strange thing for us. The Lord made this covenant with Abraham in these terms: to your descendants I give this land, from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river Euphrates. Now, the Wadi of Egypt being the Nile Delta. Now, Israel never actually possessed all of that expanse, because that includes both, you know, Egypt as well as all of the Sinai Peninsula, modern-day Israel and Canaan, and through to Lebanon and Syria. Israel never has conquered all of that, despite modern Israel probably wants to conquer good parts of that. And yet, still, there is this profound sense of the God who is doing this work. That sometimes when we, you know, try and trust in the Lord, we're presented in the same situation that Abraham faces at this moment. And sometimes we can be just blinded by the glory of what we see around us, and we can't see the obvious for the expanse of the light. We're invited still to trust. You know, sometimes it can be just so hard to trust in God, so hard to really put our hope and our trust in him. And yet Paul tells us tonight that what we are waiting for, what we are longing for, is this utter transformation. I mean, Abraham, even though we call him our father in faith, most of the time he gets it wrong. He makes this you know, great declaration. He's able to trust in the Lord in this particular moment in his life. But so often he gets it wrong. So often he makes mistakes, or he's a liar, or he's a cheat, or he's just, you know, he's a pretty gray, murky kind of character in biblical history. And yet he stands in the great line of all those who followed after him, who struggle and try to do the best that we can. And why do we do this? What's the point of all this, the striving and struggle? It's this radical transformation that Paul says that we can claim with the same power that raised Jesus from the dead. That Paul says that Jesus himself will transfigure these wretched bodies of ours, these, you know, corrupted bodies. We know our sin, we know the reality of all the ways we get it wrong, and yet God is making this extraordinary promise. All we need to do is to trust in the things that we can see, to trust, hoping against hope, that God will be faithful to this word. And he is able to do this. He is able to bring about this radical transformation of our lives, of our hearts, of our sinfulness, of all of the ways that we fail, all of the things that we get wrong. But God can do it. God will bring about this power, because he's the only one who can. Jesus was transfigured and changed to show his glory. And we can also experience that same transformation to the extent that we trust, to the extent that we open ourselves, to the extent that we admit, hey, I can't do this, but you can. Lent is this invitation for us to acknowledge that we can't do this, but God will. And God will change us, and God will transform us with the same power that God used to raise Jesus from the dead. He will change us and transform us. So let's continue to hope and to trust that God will do this extraordinary work and change our hearts to be like his, and to let us trust and have faith in him to do this work among us.